The following morn brought much change, and little change, to the little house in Elusa. A mother, dearly loved, was dead. Yet a matron, solemn but not hard, was risen out of the night to take her place. The daughters washed the body of their mother once more before turning in quietness to the task of burial. While Talthia hurried into the town to find shovels for the work, the others cleared the brush and brambles in the furthest corner of the yard. All the while, the stranger did not move from her sober counsel by the fire, the infant sleeping well in her arms. Talthia returned, having only one shovel. Barbas and Philman demanded payment, and Childra has gone to Umbra, she told her sisters. Only pious Trelton had been charitable. Fool of a man though he was, constant in his reverence for the forgotten upon their hidden thrones on the nearby mountain. They see all and know all, and what one sows that he reaps, so the old stories say, he had said to young Talthia as she waited eagerly for the shovel in his hand. The daughter spoke no surprise at hearing of the shunning, but set straight to the task in turns, removing the silt and soil from their mother's new and final bed. Grave digging is not the work of teenage girls, though they are beautiful in their virility and perfected for so many other vocations. But this did not deter them. By sundown, the work was complete. As they stood over the freshly packed earth in final esteem, the stranger also emerged from the cottage, billowing in her majestic clothing, eyes of ice, strange daggers able to see to the heart. The sisters watched her, half longing, half frightened, as she approached and knelt to mark the earth with her finger. Of a sudden, a dagger appeared in the hand which did not hold the child, and before the sisters could so much as remark or startle, she had held out the boy and sliced a stretch, deep and long, into his left forearm, pressing the wound with the hilt so that the blood would trickle naturally into the dirt. Yet with the same swift precision, the arm of her cloak was cut neatly into a bandage and wrapped over the injury. "Who are you?" Analia heard herself voice, all but unaware of the fear which caused her to tremble as she spoke. The woman did not answer, but lay the child on the earth beside the plot, and again swept the dagger across flesh. The sisters gasped in mounting terror at the sight, but this time it was not the child who bled. Rather, his nurse had marked her own forearm in a similar manner, a strong lesion filled with crimson which watered the new face of their mother. The tiny pool mixed and muddied in the markings which had been drawn. Wrapping her arm in the sleeve of her cloak, the stranger took up the child again and, with a piercing glance, but not a word, returned to the house. "Mistress," the word hung in the air. It was Talthia again, shivering in the orange light of the balmy evening. The stranger did pause then and turned, though her face was without expression. "Mistress," Talthia said, dropping her eyes to her feet. "How shall we call you?" "From this day forth I am nameless," she said, "hard but not cold. I am the mother of the boy. I am the matron of the home. But nothing more shall I ever be." She turned and went into the shadows of the home as dusk descended. That night, Talthia dreamed. She was not a dreamer, no seer nor prophetess. But that night, she saw. She saw Ethos, the island of the sea, so-called blessed realm of the God-King, home of the enchanted peace, or so the stories say. Rolling hills amidst the water, with streams and falls and clouds aplenty, she saw the great city at its heart, spires and steeples, halls and libraries, filled with long-lived men who sit a year without food to read the ancient tomes. She saw the guildsmen and crafters, enduring blissful toil in the arts of metal, cloth and husbandry. Few this island could discover without the God King's merchant ships to guide him, and fewer still believed the stories were true. For the God King was divinity himself, so his ministers say, greater even than the forgotten, ruling with a despotism so benevolent as to be rejoiced at by all who dwelt therein. So the stories say. But all that the stories say is not untrue. Of this fair land Telthia dreamed, and there amidst the fine, hope-built land rose a majestic home in which lived a woman of endless study and icy eyes. Quiet in her serenity, content in her loneliness, dwelling ages and years in service to all arts, until at long last her learning brought her to the art of motherhood, of which she had never before wondered. And as she read of the curses which plagued the vocation, as well as their sister and attendant blessings, she became at once torn and absorbed in hasty passion for a needy mastery of this high discipline. Directly she hurried to the market square, tremendous market, center of all the trade of the world, where the frigates and princes of the merchantmen, the few who know the way, make port to unload spices and fine jewels, furs and textiles and glorious woods. There, among the workmen and sailors, she found a handsome youth, supple and honest, with eyes like the grass in sunshine. It was not hard for her to woo him, soliciting him into her mansion home and feeding him with delicate meats and spicy wine until he submitted to her feminine onslaught. 7 months he lived with her as if a husband, and though they learned no lasting love, the simplicity of their lust seemed enough. In the evening of that final month, the sickness came. The sickness which the woman with the icy eyes had been waiting for. Early in the morning, nausea and hunger mixed. She knew at once that her course of hard study was now begun. In full confidence, she told her lover of her triumph, explaining her greed for knowledge in no uncertain terms, and, with the diplomacy of a scholar, informing him that he was now no longer needed. The youth was crushed, though she could not see it, so furious her zeal burned for the arts. Without food or drink or bread for the road, he left by the gate and did not return. But her attentions were fully fixed, and preparations had to be made. Servants were hired, furniture imported, vitamins and herbs brewed into necessary teas and cultures. 3 months passed, and she was not deterred. 6, and she was strong to her task. But in the 7th month, another heat awoke in her, a heat she had hardly believed that she could know. Once more to the market dock she hastened, her hand against her weightier belly, icy eyes afire for the only one who could meet this new and bizarre need. Yet though she searched, and though the sailors and workers were handsome and plentiful, to her great dismay, they were not him. With a dawning of horror, she knew that this heat in her breast and loins was no longer the simple movement of calculations. With mounting dread, she felt much more than deciphered that procreation was changing her in more ways than one. And with weeping, she fled back to her tower to brood and mourn the lost and gentle husband whom she had dismissed as a slave. The child was born, a daughter, beautiful as the starry night, with the dark southern skin of her father and the mystic icy eyes of her mother. But even as a mother, she could not look on her. She could not ply her art. Though her breasts swelled painfully, she hired a nurse, expressing only for science's cold comfort. And though the infant cried throughout the day, she forced herself into other studies, other tasks. These were the true art, she told herself. These would change the world. Not the child. Not the love for a man. But her attempts at such drunkenness were futile. It was not a fortnight before she stood on the docks of the God King's Market with servants and a nurse, a man-at-arms and trunks for travel, hiring the fastest ship she could make to sail that day as her charter. She knew not where to go, but the high seas brought her renewal. No longer steeped in the masking of her heart, she found hope in the pursuit, daunting as it stood. The captain said that the bulk of the trade traveled to three lesser island ports on their way to the cities of the world. She bade him choose the nearest, and, as the pilot set the course, she retreated to a seat set up for her on the bow, where, for what might have been the first time, she took her infant daughter from the nurse and loved her. At last, the pain in her chest found some comfort and release. The child ate and was content, and she too believed this was an art she might yet learn. It was not to be. Tathia's dream was chaotic and broken from this point on, for no sooner had the crow's nest called out the warning of raiders' sails on the horizon than fear and terror, darkness and corruption stormed into Tathia's sleep. She turned and tossed, near to waking, yet ever captive by the sight which gripped her. 15-gun ships and savage marines, trained for destruction demanded by their dark gods, dismantled the crew and disemboweled her man-at-arms. The servants were slaughtered, the nurse was raped, and she was taken captive for a hostage and concubine. The infant, great horror, was left to drop into the sea with the burning merchant ship. What happened next was harder still, for the fury and hatred of icy eyes blurred the vision. Anger and darkness were born in the woman. The Lord of the Armada had taken her for his own, but that night, as he first knew her, long hidden and forbidden forms of weirding and enchantment were unleashed from the mixture of her decades of learning and the searing pain of heart she now felt. In the morning he was found dead, yet without a mark upon him. In superstition, none would now dare come near her, even to avenge their master. Her body itself had become a poison, and her icy eyes could no longer be met by even the sternest of heart among them. Whether it was her bidding or fleeting chance could not be known, but as the sun rose, the mists of dawn did not depart from the small fleet. Screams broke the fog. The other ships were taken by the shadows. Fear of madness wrought skirmishes on the deck until throats were slit and others cast overboard. By midday, she was pressed into a dinghy at Spearpoint and left to drift as the lonely ship made to sail away into the mists, winds rising as ensign of a coming storm. The sky was already dark, and the lightning would be hard, though whether in mercy or in judgment, the destruction all but passed her by. For a day and a night she drifted, staring at the sea, until her little boat came to shore upon the sands of a land unknown. A wraith without purpose, she turned and walked inland. There was a large mountain in the distance, and it was the home of the Forgotten. Tathia spoke nothing of her dream when she awoke. Her eyes were immediately drawn to the woman who sat only paces away with her brother at the breast, pulled by a pulsing charisma both magnificent and terrible. She did not know what to believe or imagine, but she did not dare conceive of speaking of the dream, even to her sisters, child that she was. Rather rising, attending quickly to her chores, she did her best to please the new mistress of the home. To both the surprise and the nigh chagrin of much of the populace of Elusa, pleasant times soon descended upon the little house at the edge of the village. The first time the woman of the icy eyes walked into Philman's forge to purchase an iron hoe for the field behind the home of late Anira, he tried to play gruff and indomitable. He was busy to his task, tired as the day, and intent on letting the newcomer know how this town ran its business. "What do you want?" he said, not bothering to look up, pounding out the fire in his metalwork, then casting it into the barrel of the water at his side. Silence met him until he began to feel the cold uncomfortability of a hidden error creep along his spine and neck. Setting his tools aside, he turned to ask again, angered and perturbed, but found his lips struck dumb in eyes more steady than the finest steel until at last he stumbled out one word to finish his initial question. Mistress? And so she came to be known in Alusa, the mistress who took in the virgin daughters of Anera and raised the late woman's son as if he were her own. Her silver was good, though unmarked by seals, and it always bought more than was expected, both of their stock sold to her as well as of all things later purchased with it from the traders and merchants, till prosperity itself descended upon the hamlet tenfold. The fields were fertile, game was fine, and in but a few years, no one questioned if it had ever been other than it was.